take a deep breath. And in the summer I'm looking for a ride. In the fall it's all about the leaving, and in the winter I stay inside. Well, if you take a long walk in the morning, you might find it makes a better day. And if you take some time in the evening, your lover will never go away. And if you look to your own inspiration, the walls come tumbling down. Just reach for the light that's deep inside and spread it around, spread it around. In the spring I take a deep breath, and in the summer I'm looking for a ride. In the fall it's all about the leading, and in the winter I stay inside. And when the sun beats hard on the heartland, say a prayer, there'll be a bit of rain. And when the snow falls smothering the wheat fields, remember that the green will come again. And when fear rolls heavy like a storm cloud, and thunder is a threatening sound, just reach for the light that's deep inside and spread it around, spread it around. In the spring I take a deep breath, and in the summer I'm looking for a ride. In the fall it's all about the leaving, and in the winter I stay inside. And if you dance to the rhythm of your heartbeat, you'll never find yourself without a song. And if you leave things better than you found them, you'll never know the right of being wrong. And if you stand for all that you believe in, you set your sights on higher ground. Just reach for the light that's deep inside and spread it around, spread it around. In the spring I take a deep breath, and in the summer I'm looking for a ride. In the fall it's all about the leaving, and in the winter I stay inside. In the spring I take a deep breath, and in the summer I'm looking for a ride. In the fall it's all about the leaving, and in the winter I stay inside. In the spring I take a deep breath, and in the summer I'm looking for a ride. In the fall it's all about the leaving, and in the winter I stay inside.
This is Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and welcome to my 7th anniversary show. I'm celebrating with what I think is a very special show, honoring the work of Trett Fury. Now, she should not be a new name to you, as she's been recording since 1972 and has broken her own new ground in a number of ways. And one of the ways that impresses me is that in the early 1970s in L.A., when she was making her musical beginnings, she also realized that she needed more control over her sound and became one of the first women sound engineers in the U.S. That led to her working with Olivia Records and a number of artists, including Chris Williamson. They became musical and life partners and were almost the poster children of gay relationships until Trett again needed to go her own way. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Stick around and you'll hear Trett talk about her career and her music. And the music starting the show came from her latest CD, Anytime, Anywhere, from 2005. We'll be back to that album later in the show. I got a chance to sit down with Trett early last November, prior to seeing her in concert in Houston. How did you get your start in music?
My actual start in music? I started playing piano when I was 5 years old. And, by the time I was 6, I was writing music that my piano teacher would have me play for her older students. When we left Iowa, my parents sold my piano, never got me another one. So by the time I was 8, I picked up the violin. And I played violin for 4 years, or 3 years. Actually, I played violin for 5 years, but after 3 years of playing violin, where I was quite good at that too. I was first chair in the high school orchestra when I was in starting junior high. My brother came home with a guitar, at the age 11. So I picked up a guitar and that was it. I was like, mine, give me that guitar. And I started playing. I started listening to folk music. I started singing, which I never thought I could actually do. And by the time I was 13, my older brother and I were a duo, a folk duo in town in Marquette, Michigan, where I spent junior high and high school. And I've never stopped playing. So it's been 44 years now of being a singer-songwriter, not a singer-songwriter, but a folk guitarist and singer. And I started writing songs when I was 19.
You got some really great exposure very early in your career with Spencer Davis. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I had recently moved to L.A., trying to find my fame and fortune, and I had met and was partnered with June Millington, who at the time was a guitar player for a group called Fanny. And Fanny was the first all-women rock and roll band in the early 70s, and quite well established. And I moved in with June. We lived up in the Hollywood Hills, and right around the corner from us, Spencer was where Spencer Davis lived. And he knew the keyboard player, the piano player from Fanny, and was looking for a guitar player. So I auditioned for him, and he hired me on the spot. He wasn't intending on hiring a woman, but he loved the way I played. And he was, at the time, he wasn't doing his old, the Spencer Davis group rock and roll stuff. He was doing blues, and acoustic blues. And at the time, I was playing a lot of 12-string slide, lead belly style, finger picking, 12-string slide, 6-string slide. And he just loved the way I played. So I worked with him. I brought in a bass player who was a friend of mine. We became a trio. I wrote some stuff that he recorded, as did the bass player. And I worked with him for, I want to say, about a year, I think, at which point the manager of Fanny saw my talent working with Spencer and took me on as an artist and got me my first record deal with MCA Records. And so I stopped working with Spencer. I did work with him again in the mid-70s. He was doing a retro band, a retro rock and roll thing, and I played guitar with him again, but it wasn't as much fun. I was having to sing songs like Gimme Some Lovin' and I'm a Man. Singing back about I'm a Man was a little trying for me. but it was great exposure, and it was good work for me.
In 1972, Spencer Davis released an album called Mousetrap. He recorded one of your songs, and I believe you played and sang backups on it, though that's not credited on the album.
It's not. Well, who knows? In those days, they weren't as meticulous about crediting stuff. It really was, I mean, in a lot of ways, it was really almost a duo album, but it was never set up that way. But I wrote the single for the album, and I did all the guitar work and all the backup singing.
I should have phrased it as harmony singing, because the vocals were very strong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was more than just backup vocals, right. It was harmony, because we sang together through all the shows and all the stuff we did.
That album contains one of your songs, Rainy Season. That song also appears on your own debut album in 1973.
A very interesting song. I mean, it was one of my first, not my first songs, but one of the first songs that I thought had some potential. I don't even know where it came from. You know, I listen to those old songs and I think, oh my God, do I really want anyone to ever hear them again?
It sounded different on your album.
It did. And when I did it with Spencer, it was more of like a country, kind of a country folk piece. And then when I did it with Lowell George, who produced my first album, he took it in a whole different direction, a la Little Feet, and it was much, much hipper and much, much more avant-garde than the way it was done with Spencer. So they're two totally different takes on the same song. And it's not, to me, it's not one of my best songs. It's not something that I would listen to.
Well, for historical purposes, let's hear just a bit of both versions of the song Rainy Season.
What's gonna happen when the rainy season comes? Will your roof cave in on you? Will the rain come pouring through and the lightning blind your view? What's gonna happen when it's cold once again? Will you wear that ragged hat or stay in with a cat? though I can't quite picture that. What's gonna happen when I leave once again? For the winter's almost here. All the grass is fading, life's parading freezes for a while. What's gonna happen when your patience finally fails? Will you lock yourself away or hide for several days, then come out feeling great?
Are there any songs on that album you really like?
Yeah, I do. The song Laughing Holidays is a really good song. I actually have played that through the years from time to time. When I want to bring something back from that first album, I play Laughing Holidays. I think that's a nice little poetic piece.
Understand you were one of the first female sound engineers. How did that come about?
Well, I was working on my second solo album. I was working with a company called Heritage Music. It was Johnny Mercer's son, had started a record company. And I was working with a producer by the name of Morgan Cabot, whose claim to fame was The Captain and Tennille. He had produced their first album, their first big hit album. I was working with a young engineer who turned out to be my mentor and a great friend. But when I first started working with him, he had the attitude that a lot of engineers have of being a bit of arrogance, like, you can't possibly understand what I'm doing. And I'm not going to explain anything that I'm doing to you because this is my secret. And I don't like working that way. So I said, you know, I don't like feeling ignorant. I'd like to learn a little bit more about what's going on in the studio. So the studio owner, gave me a book called Modern Recording Techniques, which was like the Bible of recording in the 70s. I took it home and read it, and I understood it. And I came back the next day, and I started explaining things to Randy, my engineer, and he was like, whoa. And he was a musician who came at the engineering from a musician's point of view, as I pretty much did. But I could explain things to him that he did instinctively but didn't understand. So he said, he says, you want to work as my second engineer? And I said, absolutely. So when we weren't working on my album, I was working with him on other projects. And we worked 18-hour days, 7 days a week. You know, for a year and a half, I worked with him. Through that time, my album was sold to United Artists, but it was never released because United Artists decided, or Transamerica Life Insurance, who owned United Artists, decided to get out of the music business. So my album got dropped, and fortunately, I had the background of engineering to fall back on while I was struggling to get another deal. And I spent the next 5 years pretty much in the studio, supporting myself as a recording engineer and using all my profits, all my income, you know, disposable income on bands, putting bands together and showcasing all over LA, trying to get the next big deal. So it was really fortuitous because, you know, so many artists have to wait tables, have to, you know, work as a clerk in the supermarket, whatever, to make ends meet until you can get your next big break. But I never had to leave. Once I started, I never had to leave the music industry. And I became a pretty well-known engineer. It was hard because in the 70s, of course, you know, women couldn't possibly know what they were doing in a studio. And every session I did, every new client I had to prove myself. I had to prove that I knew what I was doing, that I knew more than they did. And it was always a struggle, but I never lost a client because once people started working with me, they realized that I had a good ear and I had a good temperament and I was easy to work with.
On your first album, there was involvement with Bonnie Raitt, Van Dyke Parks, The Millingtons, Lowell George of Little Feet. That's pretty heady stuff.
Yeah. They were all, you know, they were all friends of mine. We were all hanging out in the early 70s. Lowell I met through June. And when it was time, when I got my deal with MCA, I wanted him to be my producer. They balked at first, but they, you know, they went for it because he had a good, strong name. And he had, I believe I was his first outside production outside of Little Feet. And he was a friend of Van Dyke's, and I met Van Dyke through him, and Van Dyke and I became friends. And Bonnie, also through June. We all hung out in those days. There was a lot of great, in the house where I lived, there was a lot of music going on. Crazy Horse used to rehearse down in the basement, Neil Young's band. Bonnie would come over and Lowell would come over, and we played music, and Freebo would come around, and Joel Tepp, a harp player. I mean, there was so much stuff going on in those days. Danny O'Keefe. I mean, we were all good friends. We all played music together. I remember singing one night with Maria Muldaur and Linda Ronstadt, and Bonnie and I were singing backup, just like hanging out at a party, just singing. And I used to play fiddle a bit in the early days, and Maria always encouraged me to on my fiddle playing. And so those were really, really great, very heady times, you know. And it was a great time to be in music. That's when record companies really pretty much, some record companies supported artists, took artists on to let them mature and grow and just give you a one-shot deal. So there was, you know, there was great stuff going on in those days.
Tell me about your early connection with June Millington.
Well, I met her in 1970. I had just moved to L.A. I went to New York to find a manager when I dropped out of school and I decided I was going to pursue music. I went to New York and to play the Village, to play the Hoots, to see if I could find a manager. And I met this woman, Maggie Corey, who was Professor Irwin Corey's daughter. And her claim to fame, though, was that she was an ex-partner of James Taylor's and that she knew everybody in the business and she wanted to manage me. So I said, sure, let's try it. And immediately moved to L.A. And she had just gotten to know Fanny. I can't even remember how. I think it was through a studio and through a man named John Fishbeck, who was a friend of James's. And she brought me over to their house one night, and I met June. We started playing guitar together, and that was it. I never left. We just kind of fell in love, and musically and personally, and that was really my first lesbian relationship. And we ended up spending 2.5 years together. and didn't really play music together because that was, it was all about Fanny in those days. And, you know, we would play acoustic guitars together when we were home, but she mostly wasn't home. She was mostly on the road, which is why I eventually left, because I never saw her. She was always gone. But through her, I met a lot of people and went on to have, you know, my own career.
How did you make the transition from the big labels like MCA and Uni to Olivia?
Well, I got pretty frustrated. It's, you know, the music industry is very political, and it's also, it's a very sexist industry. It always has been, and it still is. More so, you see it in Nashville now than in LA. But, you know, I lost my deal with Uni through politics. The president who brought me into the label was fired, and all the artists that came with that president were dropped. Had nothing to do with talent. It had all to do with, you know, who you knew and or who you were sleeping with. And then when I lost my deal with United Artists through the label folding, I was really getting tired of it, and I hooked up with June Millington again after several years of absence. I decided I would produce her next album, which was called Heart Song. And I sold it to Olivia Records. And I met the women from Olivia, and they offered me a contract. And I realized that even though I didn't really want to be pigeonholed into something called women's music, here was a ready-made audience of, at the time, thousands of women who were hungry for women artists, who appreciated everything you did. And I could have total creative control over what I did. And I didn't have to sign any kind of long-term agreements. So it was a natural progression for me. And when I hooked up then with Chris Williamson through June, I became her opening act, which later, you know, developed into a duo act. But at the time, I was her opening act. And it was, you know, I was really the first sort of rock and roll singer on Olivia. I was actually on Second Wave because Olivia was trying to stay pure, women-only folk-based artists, and they started Second Wave Records to bring in more other kinds of music and women who might have worked with men and all that kind of stuff. So I was the first artist on Second Wave Records, but it felt like a natural progression. There was such beauty in those rooms and such energy of, you know, thousands and thousands of women at the time just loving the music. And they didn't always love my music, because my music was a little loud for a lot of the women. You know, they'd just say, "We want Chris, get off stage, you're too loud." And it's like, you're going to have to listen.
Your second solo album, Terminal Hold, was released in 1984 on Olivia Records' Second Wave label. From it, please tell me about the song, As If by the Wind.
Well, As If by the Wind is, you know, that was the time of, that was the early 80s. And the whole way that song, I love the way that song starts, because you hear that intro in just about every third song in the 80s, the way it kind of, bump, 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 the way the guitars build. It was a love song that I had written for somebody I had known in the 70s, working in the studios. It was a relationship that wasn't supposed to be happening. It's one of those things that just happens. My songs are all very personal. They come from different places in my life and different places I've been, and I've been in a lot of places, a lot of romantic situations, a lot of environmental situations. I've been all over the map, and it's all through my music.
I caught a glimpse of you that opened my eyes. I caught a fever quite by surprise. I stole a glance that shook me inside. As if by the wind I could carry the rain. As if by the wind that blows in the day. Oh, the wind shines, stirs up love again, sweeps it away. I sat by a window to wait for your car. You said you'd come back.
what to you is women's music?
Well, you know, it's changed over the years. At the time, you know, I came into it in 1980, which was sort of when the separatist part of women's music was sort of fading a bit. But it, to me, at the time, it was women having the ability to record music that was about women, about women's issues, and that was produced and engineered and performed by women. I think it's changed over the years as women in the industry have. You know, at the time there weren't that many women in music. Now there's a lot of women in music, and I think now the definition of women's music is still women making music, but I think it has to do with a sensibility of women dealing with women's issues, dealing with songs from the heart, songs of politics, songs that really have to do with the heart of a woman.
Is there less of that now?
No, I think there's more of it. I think, though, it's not as defined, and there's not the groups, because we've been integrated into the mainstream so much that, you know, you don't find women's culture as much as you used to. But my God, there's a ton of young artists that are doing fabulous work that are, you know, calling themselves folk/women artists. They're still, you know, they still survive in the women's world, and they survive in the folk or the rock world. You can see it just through the festivals that are still alive and thriving, like Michigan Women's Festival and National Women's Music Festival. There are so many younger artists that are coming through the ranks, and they want to play these women events.
Do you think they have a sense of history?
I think that a lot of the ones that are coming through now do. I think there was a period of time of about between 10 and 20 years where there was no sense of history, and people did not want to be identified with women's music because it pigeonholed you. I mean, I'm still pigeonholed. You know, it's funny because even like being gay is considered okay now, and the artists that came out like Melissa, like Katie, or never lost their footings, really. The artists that were initially, you know, in the lesbian movement are still pigeonholed. But I don't, that's not as true anymore. And I think that women are owning their history again. There's artists like Ember Swift. There's artists like Alex Olson, Pamela Means, and Natalia Zuckerman. And these are women who are very proud of being in women's music and that know the history and appreciate the history and follow the path of the women who've come before.
Those are all wonderful artists.
They are wonderful artists, you bet.
Your fourth solo album came out in 1990 called Time Turns the Moon. And one of the songs that really caught my attention from it is The Girls All Dance.
Well, that was from my high school years, you know, growing up in small town northern Michigan, going to the Barriga dance every Friday night, and the boys never danced. They just stand around in a big circle, and so the girls all danced with each other. And I thought, when I started writing the song, this is perfect. This is the lesbians are going to love this because we all do dance now. But it came from a place in high school and it was always amazing to me. Rarely did you see a boy on the dance floor, and it was okay to dance with girls. There was nothing wrong with that in high school because you were just dancing. And it's been a great song. Women love that song.
One hot summer night, just like the ones I remember so well, where the boys would boast about the nights with the girls who would kiss and tell.
Yeah. closer they're found. If the boys don't step in and take a whirl, they're gonna lose those pretty little girls. If the boys don't step in and take a chance, the girls all dance,
all dance.
The girls all dance with each other. The girls all dance,
all dance.
The girls all dress for each other. The girls all dance,
all dance.
The girls all talk to each other while the boys all watch. Dress for each other while the boys all watch. Dance with each other while the boys watch. The girls all dance. Watch the girls all dance.
Boys won't dance. Boys won't dance.
Watch the girls all dance.
Boys won't dance.
Boys won't dance. Watch the girls all dance.
Boys won't dance.
Boys won't dance. Watch the girls all dance.
Boys won't dance.
Boys won't dance.
Boys won't dance.
I hear a touch of Cajun or Zydeco in some of your songs. Where does that come from?
Oh, just influences are from music I hear around the world. You know, I don't do as much now because that was more when I was working with bands or working with keyboards and working with drums. I've always loved Cajun music. And again, I think my influence in that was from attending a lot of, performing at a lot of the folk festivals, especially the Canadian folk festivals. You'd hear a lot more Zydeco flavored music.
They are two able bodies and they both need work. One truck driver and a part-time clerk, making the ends meet day by day, with no luck landing any permanent pay. They are the working poor, the forgotten poor. They have borne the brunt. They are the working poor. They feel lost and stuck. They are the working poor, low on money and down on luck. Oh, working poor.
There was that touch of Cajun I was thinking of. The song was The Working Poor, also from Tret's album, Time Turns the Moon. I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your time with Chris Williamson, because that was such a very public part of your life and music career.
Yes, it was. It was. We were together personally and professionally for 19 years. And as I mentioned, I met her as an engineer on her children's record, Lumiere, and became her producer over the next 19 years, basically. I started as an opening act for her. She'd play in my sets, I'd play in her sets. Through the course of that first decade, we didn't really talk about our relationship. We sort of kept it private, but it became more and more public. And by the early 90s, people knew that we were a couple. Our music became more and more closely aligned. We started writing more together. I was going less rock, more folk, and she was more going from folk to a little more rock. And so it was a nice blending of styles and talent. And our voices were so beautifully matched that sometimes you couldn't tell one from the other. And that was something that people loved and we loved. But the more our relationship became public, the more people sort of fell to us as role models. And comes a point, I think, in anyone's professional life where if you become too identified with someone else, you lose your own identity. And I felt like I was starting to lose my own identity and my own creative control by being just a duo with Chris, because it was always Chris and Tret. And I was feeling like and Tret more than I was feeling like Tret. And I just had to step away, but it was one of the hardest decisions I've ever made personally and professionally, because I knew that there would be a lot of backlash. I knew that I would not have the following that Chris would continue to have. And I knew that people would be resentful, and they were. I mean, I struggled for the first 2 or 3 years were really hard. It was hard to get work. People were nasty to me. Not everybody, but certain elements. And I'd get emails from people saying, you can't leave. You need to stay together for us. You're our role models. You know, you're the perfect couple. How could you leave?
You were on a relationship pedestal.
Yeah, exactly. Poster children for codependency. And it just was wrong. We should have never, should have never put ourselves out there so much like that, because it just made it very difficult to move on. But it was a great run. It was a great 19 years. We had a great relationship, both professionally and personally, but it had run its course in my life. I had to move on. There are still people that won't come to my shows because they take sides. And there should never have been a side, and there shouldn't be sides.
Do you currently have much contact with Chris?
Yes. I mean, not much. We see each other at events. We were both at Michigan last year. I as a vendor, her as a performer. I saw her recently in P-Town. But we don't have a lot of contact. It's interesting because most lesbians, when they break up, they remain friends. Well, that's not the case with Chris, and I probably will never be. I think it's just still too hard. And it's harder on her, I think. So we don't have a lot of contact, but I don't think we will do any kind of reunion show like people always want. It's not where I am, and it's not where she is either.
One more question about when you worked together. How did you work out the creative process? Who sang lead? Who recorded?
Well, when we first started writing together, I would write more of the music and she would write more of the lyrics, because I'm naturally much more musically inclined, and she was more lyrically inclined. She would have a piece of lyric, and I would say, oh, and I've got the perfect melody for that. And a lot of the earlier stuff, she would sing the lead, or we would sing it together, or we would share verses, or we would alternate verses. A lot of the stuff we did, like Helen's Field, Stones from Helen's Field, things like that, we would alternate verses. As we continued to write, we started writing more integrated. We would share lyrical ideas. We would share musical ideas. And we were teaching songwriting a lot. And the more we would teach songwriting, we would always ended up writing songs that the lessons that we were teaching, we'd end up writing great songs ourselves. And those songs were probably more closely aligned in terms of having an equal share in the whole creative process of music and lyric. You know, it's hard to say who took the lead. I guess it depended on who felt more closely aligned to the lyric and to the feel of the song.
Of the three albums that you did together, are there any songs that stand out that you're particularly proud of?
Oh, boy. I think the Stones from Helen's Field is a great song. Radio Quiet was one of our favorites always. Those are two that really stand out to me, Stones from Helen's Field and Radio Quiet.
Let's take a break and hear a little of their song, Radio Quiet. It's the title track from their 1998 album.
There are places on the earth that are so quiet. You can hear the whispers of space. We stand beneath the stars and the heavens, and we search the chaos for a face. We listen to the matter for voices from another time, another place. We're a dim and lonely star. It's so lonely. Call waiting. Call waiting. Call waiting. A space between the heartbeats. A place beneath the stream.
of other heartbeats, a silhouette unseen. We listen for the whispers, for any sign at all. The radio is quiet, we're waiting for the call. Radio
Has your relationship with any of your earlier songs changed since you wrote them?
Oh, always. I think you're always reading new nuances into the things you write and finding new ways of recreating it. You know, to keep a song alive, you must. And it takes on new definition as we age and mature. And the songs that I would continue to do, there are songs that I look at and would never, wouldn't see the point in singing again, except people, for historical reasons, or people who insist on hearing Tight Black Jeans over and over again. That song doesn't hold that much, emotional charge for me, but I occasionally bring out the electric guitar and play it because people love that song.
Well, I like that song as well. and can't resist sharing with you a little of the song Tight Black Jeans. It's from Tret's third solo album, Edges of the Heart, from 1986. I've had artists tell me they've grown into some of their songs.
Yeah, that's true. That Side of the Moon is one of my classic songs, and I don't do it very often because it's a piano song, and I don't travel with a piano, and I need to figure out how to play it on guitar. But when I do perform it, it always is fresh for me because it's dealing with the issue of trust. And I think, you know, we're always dealing with our hearts and dealing with trust and trusting each other and trusting ourselves. So I can always find a fresh way of approaching that song. And one of my love songs that I wrote in the late 90s, Everyone to Me, is a song that I'm always searching for why I wrote that, where that song really came from in my heart. Because it has a lot more to do with where I am now than where I was then. And I think that's interesting because I think sometimes we channel, you know, we channel what might be coming in our lives.
The song Everyone to Me was from Chris and Tret's Radio Quiet album. But here's a bit of a live version of it. And the introduction is quite bittersweet.
We've been together 18 years now. I guess when we have our 25th anniversary, we'll have a big party like this too. What do you say?
You don't have to know everything. Some things I do not know myself. You don't have to be everywhere. There are some places you can't help. You don't have to say anything. Sometimes it's better just to be. As long as you know you're everyone, every time to me. I wonder what you're thinking when I turn to walk away. If I ever thought I'd hurt you, I'd be better not to stay. But from the moment I laid eyes on you, you were tingling with my heart. I gave up all that meant the most to me, all that I could ever be, just to make a brand new start. But you don't have to know everything. Some things I do not know myself. You don't have to be everywhere. There are some places you can't help. You don't have to say anything. Sometimes it's better just to be. As long as you know you're everyone, every time to me. I wonder what you're saying when I turn a dreaming ear. It's not that I'm not listening. It's just sometimes I do not hear. But from the moment that I fell for you, I was suspended from a line. I gave up all that meant the most to me, all that I could ever see, just to try to make you mine. Till I make you mine, till I can make you mine. Ooh. thing. Some things I do not know myself. You don't have to be everywhere. There are some places you can't help. You don't have to say anything. Sometimes it's better just to be. As long as you know you're everyone, every time to me. As long as you know you're everyone, every time to me.
That song was released in 1999 as part of a various artist compilation called NWMF Silver. The CD celebrated the 25th anniversary of the National Women's Music Festival. This show is about Tread, of course, but I don't want to gloss over the wonderful collaborations she and Chris did on their three duet albums. And one example I like shows their harmonies. It's from their 1996 album, Between the Covers, and is called Please Say.
Never ends. Baby, what I feel for you could bring a poet to her knees. I feel for you and beg the sky,
and beg the sky
for mercy.
Hear me cry,
hear me cry for mercy. Begging you, please. Oh, darling, baby, you are my wildest dream. Baby, you're my best friend. You're the love I feel for all the world. You're the love that never ends. Baby, what I feel for you could bring a poet to her knees. I feel for you and beg the sky,
and beg the
for mercy.
Hear me cry,
hear me cry
for mercy.
Please say you'll always stay right here beside me every day. Please say you'll be right by my side, begging you please. Oh darling, please. Love me when I'm down. Baby, you understand. Baby, you love me as I am. It's a love that never ends. Baby, what I feel for you could bring a poet to her knees. I feel for you and beg the sky,
and beg the sky.
Mercy,
hear me cry
for mercy. Please say you'll always stay right here beside me every day. Please say you'll be right by my side, begging you please.
Begging you.